a most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. Welcome to another episode of Orson Welles. These are his commentaries, and it's so cool that we're playing so many episodes that haven't been heard in 75 years. That's just crazy. Now, this is one that I think is one of the few that were actually floating around and are available, but it's a great episode. This episode has, first of all, it's got a great connection from Cecil B. DeMille, the great film director, to the Nazis, which is interesting. And it also has Ike and Patton kind of against each other. Interesting piece, too. And then it will have a nice telling of For Whom the Bell Tolls. So a really packed episode full of great stuff. So I hope you'll enjoy it. And tune in again next week as we bring you some more great Orson Welles commentaries. Enjoy, and have a great week.
Stay tuned to this station for KECA's new program, Orson Welles.
Orson Welles speaking. We'll start this broadcast with an amusing and little-known fact. Here goes. Cecil B. DeMille, the Hollywood motion picture producer, invented the salute used by the fascists. I'll tell you about that story in just a minute.
For just a moment, let me tell you a little about Lear Incorporated, the makers of Lear radios. The name is spelled L-E-A-R. It's very probable that you haven't seen it on a radio set, even though Lear has been making radio sets for more than 15 years. The reason is the radios Lear has been making up to now have been very special radios. Radios built exclusively for airplanes. You see, aircraft radios have to be far in advance of ordinary design, far in the lead when it comes to operating with unfailing reliability. They have to be the best the field can offer, for the security of the plane, the pilot, and the passengers often rests on them. This is the kind of manufacture that Lear knows. It's a standard that's keyed the entire Lear organization. Now, Lear is building home radios. And these instruments will share with the aircraft radios that knowledge of design, engineering skill, and ability to look ahead that have marked Lear's radio manufacture for 15 years. Later on, we'll tell you something about the sets themselves. Meanwhile, remember this when you see the Lear home radio. Since 1930, Lear has been the name men fly by. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
In spite of our political differences of opinion, and they are considerable, I must emphasize that when C.B. DeMille invented the salute used by the fascists, he didn't know he was doing any such thing and didn't mean at all to contribute to the effectiveness of Mussolini's and later Hitler's showmanship. The stiff arm greeting of the fascisti is generally presumed to be a revival from the days of the Roman Empire, but I can find no historical record that any of the Caesars were hailed by that now famous salute. The gesture first appeared in one of the more grandiose of CB's Silence, The Eternal City. The Duce loved the way all the Hollywood extras raised their arms at the approach or mention of the Hollywood Caesar, so the sawdust Caesar of modern Rome plagiarized it. As a matter of fact, a great part of the pomp and pageantry of the fascist parades and spectacles was just so much stolen Cecil B. DeMillenary. Let's not be beastly to the Germans, sang General Patton. Let's not be horrid to the Hun. Noting his tune, we said on this program we thought old blood and guts couldn't get out of that big Bavarian mess he walked into. Well, he got out. Ike Eisenhower kicked him out. This move should not come as a surprise to all of General Eisenhower's admirers, and most of General Patton's. It should be noted, however, that there are many other unpunished army officials who are being nice to the Nazis. I talked to an army friend of mine about this the other day. Not my good friend George Marshall, another George, another good friend. He's an infantry lieutenant of no historical or social renown, but he's been around quite some in this man's war. What he talked about was his general, the best darn division commander in the U.S. Army, George called him. All his life, George said, the old man spent getting the military know-how. He took over our division in 1943, and in a week we knew that here was a man we'd willingly follow into combat. When we got overseas and came up against the Germans, it really paid off. Now and then we heard from officers around us. We'd sometimes pick up stragglers and whole battalions and companies. And they'd land into their CO for all sorts of tactical errors and strategical miscalculations. But in our outfit, we never thought we'd lost a soul through any fault we could trace back to the old man. After VE Day, we got an occupational assignment in the American zone in Europe. Some of us who had some idea of Nazis looked forward to that, but we were in for a lot of disappointment. Soon we had former Nazis serve as our translators and some moving in to be our informers. They'd put the finger on anti-Nazis, accusing them of sabotage and such, and our only real friends among the Germans would wind up inside our stockade. Jews and the DPs stayed in the concentration camp. We slept in the mud and tents, and fat krauts stayed in their warm homes they'd kept by Heiling Hitler. There's only one way to get into those homes, by fraternizing. So 95% of us did. It was plain enough that the old man had no idea why he'd been killing Germans. Just fought, that was all. And how he fought. In war, he was as relentless and sure as the Mississippi. And suddenly, in peace, as shallow and uncertain as a summer breeze. I still love him. I'm convinced that I'd be dead with a bunch of my buddies if it weren't for the old man. But I do think it's unfair for a man who spent his whole life studying war and winning two of them to be expected to win the peace, too. He's been too busy learning how to fight war to learn what causes them. So spoke my friend, the second Louis, on the subject of his old general. I think George helps to explain what happened to Patton. I hear a good deal of talk nowadays about making General Eisenhower Secretary General of the New World Organization. I'm for it. If there's a better man for the job than Eisenhower, I don't know who he is. But it will be very necessary to have on Ike's staff a number of genuinely well-informed civilians so we don't repeat the mistakes we made in Germany. Are making in Germany. Mistakes we're making in Japan. And speaking of world organization, Russia is presently very much on the defensive as to what she can expect from it. We told you the London Conference of Foreign Ministers would be a flop. We're very sorry to say we were right, but don't think that flop weakened the ultimate validity of the United Nations organization. It emerges now as the only real hope of world peoples for world peace. The truth is that the atom bomb has canceled the last atom of sense in the old-fashioned notion of competitive, sovereign nationalism. Canceled that notion quite as finally as gunpowder canceled the bow and arrow. Just about everybody in the world knows this, except the leaders of the world. Just about everybody, except those leaders, realizes that keeping the peace calls for a police system and a court of law, which means final central authority, something bigger than any nation and stronger. This ceased to be theoretical or visionary and became desperately factual on August 6, 1945. Since the first atom bomb exploded, it's been as plain as the nose on Mr. Bevan's face, as simple as Harry Truman's smile, as undeniable as Stalin's mustache. Suppose the United States had tried to live together without a federal government, and even with it, you remember, we had a civil war. Suppose the states were held together by treaties and alliances instead of by a constitution and the authority of Washington. Well, California would have long since annexed Colorado, or tried to, in the interests of security. Iowa would be demanding a port on the Pacific Ocean, and Brooklyn would have taken over New York for Lebensraum. We have our troubles as it is, but just imagine what it'd be like in our part of the continent without a Congress, a Supreme Court, or a national army. Imagine what the world is going to be like, say, 50 or 100 years from now, without a world Congress or a global Supreme Court and an international army. Well, the woman from Weehawken is still writing me at great length. Sorry I haven't got room this week to deal with her latest letter in full. We'll take up the matter of fortune-telling. She took umbrage at something said on this program a while back about soothsaying and prognostication. I said there wasn't any such thing, and she says I ought to know better. Madam, you claim there are genuine fortune-tellers, honest people who can really peer into the future and tell what they see. If you know any personally, will you please ask them the following questions? Will our government agree on a fixed policy on wage levels, price control, and security in time to save us all from scuttling prosperity and wrecking domestic peace? Will our government agree to agree with other governments? Will all governments agree on one government before this one world of ours gets too small for our new toys and joins the anonymity of space as just another spinning globe of ash? The woman in Weehawken wants to know why I say the welfare of a woman on the other side of the world is her welfare. And rather than read her another one of my vest pocket sermons on the interdependence of man and one-worldness in general, I'm referring her to John Donne, who lived a couple of centuries ago and had this to say on the subject. Now this bell, tolling softly for another, says to me, thou must die. Perchance he for whom this bell tolls may be so ill as that he knows not it tolls for him. And perchance I may think myself so much better than I am as that they who are about me and see my state may have caused it to toll for me, and I know not that. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language, and every chapter must be so translated. God employs several translators. Some pieces are translated by age, some by sickness, some by war, some by justice. But God's hand is in every translation, and his hand shall bind up all our scattered leaves again for that library where every book shall lie open, one to another. As therefore the bell that rings to a sermon calls not upon the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come, so this bell calls us all. But how much more me, who am brought so near the door by this sickness? The bell doth toll for him that thinks it doth. And though it intermit again, yet from that minute that occasion wrought upon him, he is united to God. Who casts not up his eye to the sun when it rises, but who takes off his eye from a comet when that breaks out? Who bends not his ear to any bell which upon any occasion rings, but who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world? No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Now, in just a moment, I'd like to tell you about a new motion picture, but first, an important announcement.
Way back in 1930, Lear began making radios for airplanes. Now, Lear is making home radios as well, and what radios they are. A whole line of handsome sets you'll delight to look at and listen to. Some have television. Some include high-fidelity, static-free FM. There are models with record players and automatic record changers. And some will have the new Lear wire recording you've been reading about. With all their fine background and unusual excellence, you'll find Lear radios are not high in price. The masterpiece of them all, that includes television, automatic record changer, and the best of everything, is $500. At the other end of the line, there's a very capable, good-to-look-at table model at $19.95. The one best way to appreciate what Lear is contributing to home radio is to hear these new sets themselves. Soon you can go to your Lear dealer and have him play them for you. We're sure you'll agree that you get more radio value for every dollar you pay for a Lear radio. And now a few words about next week.
In Hollywood, you know, we've never managed to make the grade of spy thriller, which is the best thing the British do in movies. I think I have the right to say this because I've written a couple of these and produced one of them, and my spy stories are even worse than my compatriots. Now I'm glad to announce that a picture about secret agents and such characters, good enough to stand with Hitchcock, I mean his English period, and the top Carol Reed, has finally been made in America. The film is called The House on 92nd Street. It's playing at your local theater now, or will be soon, and I beg you to see it. My time's up now. Next week we'll talk about the Nuremberg trials and that music man I've been promising, putting off for so long. I hope to have something more worth your attention. Anyway, please let me come to call again, and thanks for this time. Until then, my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radio, and I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.